Beach easy.
You know, I feel like that moment honored all of those women who came before me, who struggled for so long, who never received the credit for what they did, were just as beautiful and smart and resilient and strong as me, but never had the opportunity to stand there in that moment. And so I quote Maya Angelou when I say, in that moment, I felt like I come as one, but I stand as 10,000.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. From personal growth and self-discovery to challenges and victories, we discuss it all. Join us as we dive into the extraordinary stories of ordinary people all the way to the end.
I'm Julie Ellis, and today I'll introduce you to Dr. Tracy Bailey, who has an amazing story. Tracy is an educator and author of a book called Forever Free, A True Story of Hope in the Fight for Child Literacy. She's been through a lot in her life, but she's remained true to who she is and the standards she has always set for herself. Her story begins in Georgetown, South Carolina, where Tracy was born into a family with six older siblings. Tracy, what was it like growing up in Georgetown?
Well, I had a really interesting childhood, I think. As you said, I am the youngest of seven children, and all of us grew up in the church, so much so that my mother tells a story about the first time that she took me to church, the pastor looked at me and nicknamed me Benediction because I was the last of the seven children, and I always think that's a funny story. I remember singing in the choir when I was a tiny little girl, being in Sunday school, and just always being surrounded by just hymns and the songs of the church and singing. But at the same time, my dad was a huge Sam Cooke fan. And I remember that he had all of these 8-track tapes. And when I was a little girl, he had an 8-track player in his car. It was a Ford LTD. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he would let me sit on his lap and steer the car as we went down our little dirt road to get to our house. And Sam Cooke would be playing on the cassette tape. And these are just beautiful, perfect memories for me.
Tracy's father had a profound impact on her life. Although he dropped out of school when he was just in eighth grade, Tracy adored his love for words and unique outlook on life. He went back to school in his 80s to receive his GED, but sadly didn't finish before he passed away.
He just saw so many things during his lifetime and just really passed on to me a love for words, a love for the written word and the spoken word. He had this very unique gift of being able to come up with rhymes right on the spot. And so he would look at you, and then before you knew it, he would have you laughing because he'd say something that just rhymed, you know, right there in the moment. So I feel like he could have been a great songwriter, or my mom says he could have been a musician if he wanted to to really give his life to that. But instead, he was just the greatest daddy of all time.
Tracy grew up in a community which was a place of love and learning, and she was blessed with parents who instilled in her the importance of hard work, determination, and sharing.
So if there was a bucket of butter beans, half of that would probably go into our freezer after my fingers felt like they would fall off from shelling those butter beans. And then the other half would go down the road to a cousin or a neighbor or somebody else in the community.
Yeah.
My parents really instilled in me a love for our community and looking out for other people and really making sure that if you had more than enough, you were sharing it with others.
Tracy really did have a wonderful childhood, surrounded by people who loved her and supported her in everything she did. But as she got older and attended public school, her eyes were opened to racial injustice and inequality.
I remember growing up in this community that for me felt insulated and sort of isolated in a way. I know that there were white families in my community, but those were not the people that I interacted with. Mm-hmm. So the people that I saw in my community mostly looked like me, mostly knew who I was, would step forward to, I think, act in my best interest in a lot of situations. But when you go to school and you start interacting with other people, you begin to notice how that's not always the case when you're a little brown girl. And you wonder why the kids that are being sent to the principal's office all look like you. And you wonder why the kids that are sometimes, you know, called out to be in the lower reading groups all look like you. You wonder those things. Mm-hmm. You kind of understood after a while that you were the problem and people were trying to fix you. They were trying to fix the way that you talked. They were trying to fix the way that you wore your hair. Mm-hmm. You know, things that didn't necessarily stand out as bad mm-hmm. in your community would be the focus of a lot of attention when you were outside of your community. Mm-hmm. And the people in your community also understood that, and they wanted you to be able to go far. So then they would try to focus on those things as well. So there was always this, I think I write in the book also about this double consciousness.
Yeah.
About how you see the world, but also how people are seeing you, you
right.
know? Even if you didn't know how to articulate it, mm-hmm. it was going on behind the scenes even when you were a young child.
I want to ask you how you process that throughout your life, but there's no easy answer to that. I'm sure it's
definitely
a very,
not.
Very long answer.
Yeah.
But that it
yeah.
just kind of is a red thread, though, through your life is what I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, I would yeah. say so. I think that you become aware of the society around you. I mean, you. Mm-hmm. I was born in the 70s, as mm-hmm. I said in my book, and I don't think we as a country can just turn our heads away from our history mm-hmm. and just bury our heads in the sand and say that there were never enslaved Africans right here where we're sitting right now.
Right.
You know? So I think that all of those things have an influence on where we are today, how we navigate the world, how we get along with one another, mm-hmm. and to say that they don't matter because so much time has passed
right.
is ridiculous,
right?
I think. And so when you're aware of that, you make certain choices to move yourself forward or to figure out how to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and keep your sanity at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In high school, Tracy started to think about what she wanted to do with the rest of her life. One day, she overheard a teacher talking about her, and what she heard had a profound effect on her choice.
I knew that I liked reading and writing. Mm-hmm. I remember being in the 11th grade at Georgetown High School. I remember walking into my advanced placement English class. My teacher was standing at the door. Her name is Miss Gordon. She's the best teacher in the whole world. She happened to be talking with Miss Vereen, who was standing next to her. We were all going into the classroom, and I overheard her tell Miss Vereen that she thought I was a good writer. And I don't think that she knew that I was listening in on their conversation. And so it had a big impact on me that they were having that conversation. And I thought that she was being genuine and honest about how she felt.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the first times that I ever thought of myself as a good writer.
Right.
And thought that maybe that could be a part of my future. But I really wanted to be an attorney.
Okay.
Because I used to love to watch a show called L.A. Law.
Right.
And characters on that show drove fancy cars. And I wanted to have a candy apple red Porsche. I told my dad, that's my dream.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to college and took the LSAT, and I just realized that maybe that wasn't going to be the right path for me.
Right.
But I do remember being in an education classroom at the College of Charleston mm-hmm. and reading in one of my textbooks that the population of teachers would become increasingly white as the years went on, and the population of students in classrooms would become increasingly brown as mm-hmm. the years went on. And so I thought to myself, I know what kind of impact it has for a brown student to have a brown teacher. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll just give 5 years of my life to education. And maybe that way I'll be able to give back. I can go to law school and then I can get the Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
But it just didn't end up that way.
One day, in that same English class that inspired her love of education, a senior came in and gave a presentation about a program that would go on to change Tracy's life. She applied, and with the help of an application fee waiver, she was accepted into a summer college program at the Governor's School for Academics at the College of Charleston. While she was there, she met someone very special.
First day I was there, I was kind of walking around, looking at things, and I was by myself, and this really cute guy walked up to me, and he extended his hand, and he said, "Hi, I'm Ike." And I said, "Hi, I'm Tracy." And we kind of smiled at each other, and we kind of walked away. But I would see him throughout the 5 weeks. Like, this kid was everywhere, and everybody knew his name, and everybody seemed to be drawn to him. And it's funny because 8 years later, that kid was my husband. I mean, over those years, he became my best friend. He was the person that I wanted to tell when I had a triumph or when I had a tragedy. He was the person that I wanted to spend time with. I mean, I think because of the fact that he is a stutterer, he is a great listener. Mm-hmm. And he was just always there for me for a long time, and he was very supportive. I took him for granted. I just was not there for him in the same way that he was there for me until I realized that, well, until he actually said to me, "That's enough. We just don't need to be playing these games. I'm ready to go on with my life, and I know what I want out of life, and I don't think you want the same things." And it really broke my heart. I was just miserable for the longest time. And then I had to say to myself, "You are so silly." Because you are going to let the best thing that ever happened to you in your life go, get away from you because of something so superficial. Is that really what you want to do? Mm-hmm. So that's when I made a decision that I am going to absolutely go after this cute guy.
I love it. How long after that did you get married?
About a year later, we got married.
And now you've been married for how long? 26 years?
In August, we'll celebrate our 25th wedding anniversary.
Tracy and Ike had two children, a boy and a girl. They moved their family to Myrtle Beach, where Tracy got a teaching job and Ike became a columnist for a local newspaper. The unstoppable Tracy eventually earned her master's degree from Coastal Carolina University while working and raising their children, all with the loving support of her husband. Tracy told me that one reason why their marriage has been so successful is that she and Ike are united in their goals around helping their community. They ultimately ended up starting a nonprofit organization called Freedom Readers. Tell me a little bit about the Freedom Readers program.
So Freedom Readers is an after-school and summer literacy program. It's designed to help improve reading skills in low-income communities. So we will establish a site and invite about no more than 20 children to take part in a session. And we will recruit one tutor for each child who's in the program so that they can develop a relationship and that tutor can help that child choose the right book for them. At the very end of our time together, we focus on public speaking. So all of the young people get an opportunity to stand up and make a speech. Now, this takes me back to our conversation about my childhood. While my dad was reading to me every night before I went to bed, my mom was really insistent that every year around this time of year, I would get an Easter speech at my church. And I would start to learn that speech. And she would come home from work, and before she would even put her purse down, she would look at me and say, "All right, say your Easter speech." That was like every day. And then there was this contract that we had together. It wasn't written, but she let me know that she would buy me a big Easter basket, and she would always hide it in her bedroom behind a certain chair, and I would go and look at it, and, you know, she'd never bring it out until Easter. Mm-hmm. But the deal was, if I did not stand up in front of the church on Easter Sunday and make my speech in a way that everybody could hear and there were no mistakes, then the Easter basket was going to stay with her. So she would sit on the front row with her arm around the Easter basket as I was standing there giving my speech.
Enticing right in the front row.
Yes.
Why did she make you do that?
She made me do that because she wanted me to be able to speak to groups of people with confidence, going back to what we said about the world trying to change you and about a voice being the most dangerous thing that you could have, she wanted me to be able to use it in a way that would be acceptable, that would be embraced, and that would open doors for me in the future. So I'm very, very glad that she was so insistent. Now, my sister, on the other hand, said that it traumatized her for life and she never wanted to do any public speaking. But I have gone on to do lots of public speaking since then.
Yeah. Well, it's powerful to teach your child that they have a voice and how to use it in a meaningful way. I think that's really powerful. Good for mama.
Absolutely. And what I wished is that my teachers at school understood her pedagogy. That's a big word we use in education about how we, it's the art and science of teaching and learning, right?
Yeah.
And so what I regret is that many of my teachers thought that there was nothing really going on in our community in terms of education. But there was so much going on there. And that was just one aspect.
Oh, you mean in your community at home?
Yeah,
and
my
church,
community at home and at
school.
Church.
Yes.
Yeah, and outside of school. There was always this, we would always elevate and lift up and prioritize the education that we were getting in the public school. But as an adult, I was able to look back and see there was just as much education going on in my church, in my home, in my community, through the ways that the adults in my life pushed me forward and said, you will do this, whether or not you want to do it, you will develop these soft skills that you're going to need later in life. And that's why public speaking is such a big part of the Freedom Readers program as well. So a lot of what I learned from public school and from my community is incorporated into the Freedom Readers program.
What propelled you to develop the Freedom Readers program?
I think that I, for one, was really struck by what was happening in my community around the election of Barack Obama. There were so many people who had not been engaged in politics before who were, and this is to not make our conversation about one party or another or make this polarizing. But what inspired me was watching how inspired the people around me were, being able to see someone who looked like them be elevated to the highest position in our country. And I wanted to be able to capture some of that energy because I knew that once the election was over, that some of that would dissipate. And so many things were happening with our children. I was learning that children of color were at the bottom of the list when it came to reading scores and when it came to academic achievement. And I really wanted to do something to address that. So that was kind of what motivated me to take those first steps.
Do you see that as a significant part of your story with your husband? Because
you're,
as a couple, have been devoted to trying to make a change through, you know, education, him through his voice as a journalist.
Right.
You know, you're not just sitting back doing nothing, eating bonbons or whatever, right? You're out there.
Right.
You're actually walking the walk. And to me, that's a powerful part of your story.
You're right. You're right. I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's just not easy every day. That's what I'm saying. It's not easy every day.
No, I understand that.
When I was working on my dissertation, he would tell me very often, he would look at me and say, if it was easy, everybody'd be doing it.
That's right. And you
it's
said,
not supposed to be easy. That's what he would say.
Well, exactly. It's not many people do it and not many Black women do it. Isn't that one of your motivating factors that I read about in the book? Why you wanted to pursue your PhD?
Absolutely. It's just, I think representation matters. And I think that the young people that I work with, whether it's in a school or if it's after school, wherever, I just want them to be able to see and say to themselves, this is not out of the question for me. If she was able to do it, then I can do it too.
Well, it was a big step and it was a big commitment to a big program.
And but Julia didn't feel that way in the beginning.
Well,
it just felt like one step.
That's exactly right. We do big things a little at a time. Speaking of big things, I want to talk to you about you getting your doctorate degree and then later get into the story about your dissertation, because I think that is so interesting. Why did you decide to pursue your doctorate?
Well, by that time, we had decided that we wanted to make Freedom Readers the most effective organization it could be. And I felt like I needed that kind of training to be able to build a program that would last and would really make a difference in the lives of young children. Mm-hmm. So that's why I decided to pursue that degree.
While all of this was happening, Tracy and Ike decided to move their family to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where Ike took a job writing a column in the local newspaper. Tracy continued to work on her doctorate degree, and before too long, she was ready to present her dissertation. Tell me about your project and what it was like presenting it on that day. I know it didn't go the way you planned, and I think the way you handled it, though, is very interesting and inspiring.
So the study was called Environments of Excellence, and what I wanted to do is go into the homes of two families that were involved in the Freedom Readers program and document what I mentioned earlier, what I like to call that home pedagogy, mom's approach to teaching, because I know that my mother was doing it for me. And so I wanted to be able to document that in these two homes. And that's what I was able to do. I spent about 6 months recording interviews and just observing. And then I wrote that up to share in my dissertation. The purpose of all that was to just make teachers and the educational community aware that we really need to do more work on reaching out to the other side of the educational scale. It shouldn't just be a one-way street. We could impact kids and make a greater difference if there were more collaboration. Mm-hmm. And so when it was time for me to defend my dissertation, there was a meeting established. We all got together. I had some slides that I put together. I talked about the study and everything that I learned. And my committee was a group of four professors there at the university. Asked me to step outside. I came back into the room. I sat down. My advisor said to me, "We've talked about it and we don't think that you're going to pass today. We want you to take additional classes and we want you to try this again at the end of the summer." So that was in May of 2013. It is now April of 2023. It's 10 years later. And I'm still looking back on that moment, like just shaking my head, because I was just completely devastated by that news. I know that the committee and each of the committee members had something or several things that they wanted me to look at again and really kind of tweak and adjust.
Yeah.
And I think one of those things was, you know, making sure that you do not use the deficit model. And they said that some of my writing in the paper was reflective of a deficit model, which is a focus on what people don't have instead of what they do have, what they can't do instead of what they are doing. I can remember having a conversation with one of the committee members about the difference between the term low wealth and low income, right? Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't really thinking in those terms. I thought I was saying the same thing with both of those terms. But she pointed out to me that by saying low wealth, I was implying that they did not have any worth or any wealth in other ways, in cultural ways, and what they could do and what they understood. Low income just meant that they were lacking money. Mm-hmm. Low wealth meant that they were lacking worth, right? So I'm like, it's a distinction that I hadn't thought about. So I changed the mission of the organization from we want to improve reading skills in low wealth communities to reading skills in low income communities, because I could see that. But I feel like there were a lot of other things like that, because what my advisor said to me was, I've never seen a student. We had this conversation like 3 days before the defense. I've never seen a student go to the defense and not pass. She said, "I've read everything. We've worked on everything together." She said, "I don't want you to worry about this." She said, "There will be things that the committee will point out and say, work on this, work on this, work on this. But they'll tell you, congratulations, Dr. Bailey. Mm-hmm. You'll make those changes and you'll submit them. And then we'll see you at graduation."
How did you feel at that moment when they said, "We will not pass you today"?
It is hard to describe how I felt at that moment. It was almost like an out-of-body experience. I felt like I could not have been hearing what I was hearing because I had no warning. I never really expected. Of course, I was nervous, but it's no one said to me that this was a possibility for this particular day.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that sometimes people in power wield their power in just ways that are sometimes arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that's the case.
What did you do after you walked out of that room?
I walked out of that room and got into my car and called my husband and told him what happened. And he was shocked. And there was a 2 hour and 45 minute drive from Columbia back to Myrtle Beach. And I cried for the first half. And then the second half, I thought to myself, now, wait a minute, this didn't play out the way my advisor said that it should have played out, right? What in the world is, I kept asking myself, what just happened? I don't know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that when I got home, I would send letters to each one of the committee members and let them know that I really wasn't in a position to continue to take classes. We were financially limited on what we were going to do. I had already started a nonprofit. I was going to continue to work with those families because I felt like it was making a difference. And I wasn't going to spend my time continuing to work on this paper or
because
taking any more classes.
They wanted you to take additional classes. Yeah.
I said, I'm just not going to do that. And what I need from you is I need you to tell me what was so egregious about this particular study that you couldn't ask me to make corrections and then we could move on.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I need from you. And then they started to respond. And they started saying, well, I really can't think of anything that was all that egregious. I mean, if you go on to teach at a university, you could actually take those classes there. And I don't. And then it was like, if so-and-so is okay with it, then I'm okay with it. And then the last professor, the one that had the really big problem with the difference between low wealth and low income, she comes back the next morning with an email that says, well, now you sound like an advocate for children, as if I wasn't sounding like an advocate for children before. They agreed that it was all right, and I graduated in May.
Do you feel like that? I'm sure it felt to you a little bit like a failure, as you just said, even though from hearing the stories, obviously was not a failure. It was obviously a victory, and you had a couple confused people hung up on stuff that it was irrelevant. But that's just my little aside there. But you just told me something very powerful about who you are by the way you handled that. You didn't fold. You felt the grief. You said you cried halfway home.
Mm-hmm.
And then your brain snapped into action because you knew you, because deep down you knew who you were.
Mm-hmm.
You knew the work you did
mm-hmm.
was valid and your heart was in it and that it was right.
Mm-hmm.
So you had enough confidence to send those emails and question them, as was your right to do.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely sounds like. So you showed up with some courage. Even though you kind of got knocked down and they threatened your self-esteem, but you had enough to go beyond that and question and get a good result.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and that's commendable because a lot of people wouldn't do that. A lot of people would have just crumbled.
Well, thank you for saying that. And I just think I have to give all the credit to my parents. They were the ones who instilled in me from the very beginning, this is who you are.
Mm-hmm.
This is how you show up in the world, you know? And when push comes to shove, you go back to those things that are just the ultimate essential truths of your life. And that is one of those, that I'm valuable, that I have worth, and that I am supposed to be doing a particular work.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of what other people are doing or what they say, or, you know, so yeah, you get knocked down, but then you remember who you are.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's happened to me too in work and life. You know, where somebody comes along and just wants to knock you down, and it's seductive. right? Because mm-hmm. you remember those childhood insecurities and the things you overcame, and sometimes it gets to you, but you can, if you've got it and you're grounded with that self-esteem, you can pull yourself back.
Mm-hmm.
But to experience that when you know who you are is, it rocks you. I know,
because
it's happened to me. And, but that's it. It's the grounding. It's the grounding that you got and knowing who you are.
What I try to tell my children now is that things are not always going to turn out the way that you expect them to turn out,
mm-hmm.
right? But sometimes things happen for a reason. And so what are the lessons that we can learn from this? Are you stronger as a result of this? Are you going to reach more children and be more committed to your work because of having gone through this trial? So then that's the blessing.
Well, that is exactly where I was going next.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you if you believe that we go through those things, or you went through that for a reason. And it sounds like that's exactly what you think.
Yeah.
Like maybe God was like, okay, let's learn this lesson one more time.
Mm-hmm.
So you know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And you go forward knowing that and not ever let anybody let you question your own confidence again.
Yeah.
Do you believe that sort of?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think up until that point, I had a sense of who I was, but it was like in that moment, mm-hmm. the question was, okay, so are you really who you say you are? Are you going to be able to walk this out? And so once you do it, once you actually pick yourself up and move on, then when things come at you in the future, you're just like, okay, wait a minute now. I've already slayed the giant, right?
Yeah.
And so whatever comes next, let's just fight it out because I know who I am. I mean, you're not going to break me. You're not going to make me think that I'm not who I am. So let's tangle with this.
Amen.
Yeah.
When you received your hood on the stage, how did you feel?
Oh, that was such a great moment. I think I write in the book about feeling like there was a cloud of witnesses there with me. You know, I feel like that moment honored all of those women who came before me, who struggled for so long, who never received the credit for what they did, were just as beautiful and smart and resilient and strong as me, but never had the opportunity to stand there in that moment. And so I quote Maya Angelou when I say, in that moment, I felt like I come as one, but I stand as 10,000. So that was such a great, great moment. Nothing could have gotten in the way of my enjoying that particular moment, because it wasn't for me. That moment was for all of the members of my family who came, the members of my community, people associated with Freedom Readers. That moment was for ancestors. I'll never be able to speak their names. That's what that moment was for.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just gave me chills, like from head to toe.
Yeah.
That is super powerful.
Yeah.
That's amazing. What year was that?
That year was 2013.
2013.
That happened in 2013. You know, when I reflect on things like that and I think about what I had to go through and how I felt, and I start to think about the indignities and the injustices and the sexual violence that women like me went through 100 years before I was born, or 200, 300 years before I was born. Really, actually, in the grand scheme of things, I was sitting in a room having a conversation with some ladies, and they were fighting for their lives every day. So I even feel a little silly, you know, talking about it, but when I'm able to understand the context of history, I just rejoice in how blessed I am.
Amazing.
How privileged I am to be sitting here having this conversation with you today.
Powerful. After Tracy finished her doctorate degree, it wasn't long before her life would change again. Shortly after receiving her degree, Ike received some news that would have a profound impact on their life.
Well, shortly after I received that hood and had that moment, maybe a few days before that, he found out that he was accepted into the Nieman program at Harvard University, which is a program for 24 journalists, 12 from around the country and another 12 from around the world, who spend a year on the campus of Harvard just becoming better journalists. So I was super excited to be going to Harvard, you know, and being able to sit in their library and just audit classes and do great things. And in our first couple of months there, he discovered that he was having some weakness in his legs and in his feet, and he didn't understand what was going on. We had gone to see a chiropractor, a podiatrist, lots of different people. Nobody could really diagnose it. We finally found a doctor in Boston who said, "I think I know what this is." And he diagnosed him with something called CIDP, which is a very long term. It's chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy. And it just means that your nerves are not communicating with your muscles in the right way. He got that diagnosis on my birthday in 2013, in December, and started treatments early in 2014. And the course of treatment that was prescribed for him just was not the right course of treatment. And he ended up having lots of complications and spending more than a week in the hospital with a 104-degree fever. And so we just didn't know what was going to happen. It was a really tough time. This is on the heels of everything that I've just, you know, faced and have gone through. We've got our kids in school there. It is the snowiest winter in Boston, and that's saying a lot. In 20 years, they said there was a nor'easter or something.
And you're not used to any snow.
No, I'm not used to any snow. I mean, my kids kept me going because we had a friend who loaned us a snowsuit for my daughter, and she would go and make snow angels in the snow. But my son didn't have one, and he just laid down in his jeans and just made snow angels. They had the best time.
I bet.
Playing in the snow. But it was just it was a lot to handle, a lot to deal with. And again, there were some very dark days where I spent just lots of days in bed and would get up when it was time for the kids to come home from school. And then I would read with them and make dinner and do laundry and all those things that you had to do to keep the house going, because my husband was just not in the physical shape or the mental shape to take on that kind of thing.
Was he in a wheelchair for some time?
There were times when I needed to wheel him into the hospital because he was having difficulty walking. It wasn't like he was spending all of his time in a wheelchair, but there was a time where he had a blood clot on the bottom of his foot. It was very painful and difficult to walk on that. So he was on crutches for a while in the middle of the snow, trying to get around in Cambridge, Massachusetts. But we got through that as well.
How did you get through that? What did you focus on besides your kids?
I focused on, once again, those people who loved me when I was a little girl and who told me, "You belong with us and that we think you're beautiful and smart." And so I was able to take a fiction writing class at that time. And I began to build characters like those people who were around me when I was a child, and started to tell stories, and eventually ended up putting those stories together in my book, Riverside Blues, that was published in 2019. But it gave me so much comfort to feel as if I were transported back home, mm-hmm. where the sun was really shining, not that little little weak thing they have in Boston. They call it the sun. It's a little yellow thing in the sky that shows up a couple hours a day. But no, where the sun beams down on you and you feel like it's giving you a hug and a kiss, and we're all at a cookout and everybody's listening to like the Commodores and we're dancing in the yard. And I just had to transport myself at times to a happier place.
That's a great tactic.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's all you can do, is just put your brain in a happy place, and that's all you need to do to get through.
Yep. And the second thing I did was call my mama, and she got on a plane.
Nice.
She came marching through that airport, and she was like, "Listen, this is what we're going to do." And, you know, she made us meals, and she made sure that my husband was eating what he was supposed to have, and she helped out so much. It was so good to have her there at that time. She just really showed up for me.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
For how long did your husband battle that illness?
He went through treatments, I think, all through the time that we were there in Boston. After we came back to Myrtle Beach, he did some additional treatments at Duke University. He has a neurologist there. And then maybe about 3 years later, they told him that he was in remission and that he didn't need any more treatments. And so he hasn't had any treatments now in 6 or 7 years and will run 5 miles a day.
Wow.
So it's just such a testament to, I mean, there were days that I wasn't sure that we would ever be able to get back to our lives that we knew before he had that diagnosis.
Because you needed to help him do basic things in life. There were days. You must have been terrified that
I was terrified. There were days that I needed to tie his shoes and, you know, help him button his pants and button his shirt. And I just didn't know what was going to happen. How were we going to feed our family? How were we going to take care of our children? I was going to need to make sure I could, you know, find a way to support the family, take care of everybody. I just felt like it was all on me. Mm. But looking back at that now, you know, you just don't know what's around the corner. You just don't know what life has in store for you.
Nope.
So what is the point of ruminating on the worst case scenario? You know?
Bingo.
What is the point of spending hours and hours thinking about how this could be the end? It could be the end, but it also could be the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I learned through that experience to always leave room for hope.
Amen.
Yep.
I wanted to ask you about a part of the book where you mentioned that a doctor introduced the idea to you of ACEs. Adverse childhood experiences as they relate to illness.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak to that for a moment?
Yeah. So Isaac and I were both able to spend some time with a professor at Harvard who had done a lot of research on these, they're referred to as ACEs, these adverse childhood experiences. Science is now telling us that if you have experienced a certain amount of trauma as a child, it shows up in your life later on when you're an adult through different health issues, heart attacks, high blood pressure, diabetes, strokes. There has been a direct line drawn between these health issues and the trauma that you experience as a child. There's a doctor by the name of Nadine Burke Harris, who's also done a lot of work on ACEs. And it was just really fascinating to me because I thought about my husband's childhood. He grew up in a household where there was some abuse. His father was an alcoholic. And he just really had to grapple with whether or not what he was dealing with health-wise was connected to some of those experiences and events. The good news is that can be mitigated, though, by strong relationships, by stable relationships and people in your life who really help you understand that you're going to be okay. And so it became extremely important for me to make sure that the kids in the programs where I worked had at least one person around them that they could look to support them. And that's not to say that the families that participate in these programs aren't all stable families. They could be. But if some kid is struggling, then we could provide for them a safe space and a mentor.
That is huge. And I'd never heard, I mean, I've studied and read a lot about health and how trauma, especially as a child, I mean, that's stored in your cells.
Mm-hmm.
It does not go away. And it can manifest itself, whether you even remember abuse or not, as illness, as mental illness, as physical illness. And the only way to deal with that is to deal with the trauma, to go back and process that. It's unprocessed trauma.
Right.
So that was really powerful. And when I read that in your book, I was like, and I'll be looking into that more because they should be talking about this more when it comes to disease.
Mm-hmm.
But PTSD, trauma, and illness, it's all related in most cases, and it's really very, very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So was your husband able to process that trauma?
Mm-hmm.
And then do you think that had an effect on his recovery?
That's a good question. First, I want to recommend that you and your listeners Google ACEs and go online, and you can pull up the ACEs test. And there are actually a number of questions. And if you score like 7 or higher on the test, then there's some information that you get about how you may be in a risk zone. And the doctor that I mentioned earlier, Nadine Burke-Harris, has a really great TED Talk about this because she was warning all pediatricians to use this ACEs test or this ACEs score to help them guide treatment for kids who were suffering from things like asthma and other things, and just make this a more integral part of the way that we approach our our health care. Yeah.
Wow.
So my husband, after our time at Harvard, published a book called My Brother Muchi, where he kind of walked through a lot of the experiences that he had as a child and how it impacted him. And I think that, you know, after receiving some therapy and thinking through some things, that it's an ongoing process.
That is interesting and very thought-provoking. At least I hope it is for people who are struggling with physical and mental problems.
Right.
Because hate to be cliche, but boy, it does go back to childhood. It really does.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I read about it, the more I talk to people, you know, like you who've experienced some of that, I find that very intriguing.
Yeah.
Well, as I look through my notes, I feel like we've covered the biggest trials of your life that you were able to get through with confidence and with grace, with hope, because you've had a powerful upbringing. So now you're 50 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say you're halfway through your life. You have the second half to go.
Mm-hmm.
What goals do you have for your future?
I think that the rest of my life is going to be about trying to inspire and encourage people of all ages and at all levels. And I'm looking for the opportunities to take what I've learned, the lessons that I've gained, and share those with young people who have fresh legs and fresh eyes, you know? I'm looking for ways to invest in young people so that the next great idea will have the kind of support that it needs, so that other people will not have to go through the same types of struggles that I went through.
What kind of legacy do you hope to leave for your kids and possibly grandkids?
I hope that I will be remembered as someone who didn't just talk about change, but really went about change, you know, that really lived the kind of life that I always talk to other people about living. There's another really great Frederick Douglass quote that I think of often. He said, "I prayed for 20 years and never got an answer until the day that I prayed with my legs." And so if I can inspire other people to see ways that they can make a difference and step forward and do what they can in their sphere of influence, then that will be a fantastic legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And at the end of your life, what do you believe happens when you transition after the body dies?
Well, after the body dies, I really feel like the spirit, the soul, returns to its home. I honestly believe that everybody gets to be reunited with the Creator. And I really don't believe that the kind of Creator that I believe in is not going to punish people forever in an afterlife. You know, I feel like going back home is being embraced and is being welcomed. It's having your memory erased of all the bad things that ever happened when you were in that body. And it's total and complete and utter freedom.
So am I safe in saying you're not fearful of dying?
I mean, I think we all have some fear. We all have some fear. But that image that I hold it's a beautiful one. And I believe that's what happened when my dad left this earth. And I feel like one day I'll be able to see him again.
Dr. Tracy Bailey will be the first one to tell you that she was extremely blessed to have been raised by strong, supportive parents who instilled in her the importance of reading, community, hard work, and resilience. The little girl who was taught to use her voice chose to use it to help others, and in turn give others the opportunity to find freedom in literacy and find their own voices for change. If you've been inspired by this story or any others, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review.
We don't just get away at the beach, we get together. Because no matter what floats your boat, we're floating right along with you. With over 2,000 restaurants, live music all day and night, and endless attractions, Myrtle Beach was made for having fun and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 miles where you belong, the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.